Welcome to Disc Golf History and Legends, sponsored by Blue Power Disc Golf. And here is your host, Scott Stokely.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another show. I think we're at week 4 or 5 now, and we're just starting to pick up momentum. So, you know, as the nature of live TV, we'll call it TV, kids don't know the difference, there's those children on tour, but we have all sorts of unexpected things come up, and we were going to do a History of Disc Golf in Washington podcast tonight. We're going to be postponing that again because one of our really special guests isn't able to get on, but we are going to do Washington. You have my word. So I want to give a quick introduction about this podcast. I'll probably do this every show. I think it's essential. And the idea here is that I want to capture the history of our sport. I mean, this is going to be low budget. There's not any editing. There's not going to be any, old video footage spliced together, right? But what I'm going to do is I'm going to be talking to the people that are part of the history of this sport. And I plan on doing this for at least a couple hundred episodes. I'm going to do one for every state, every country, manufacturers, famous tournaments, organizations. And one of the things I want to do is talk to the legends of the sport. And I'm hoping that by focusing an hour of our time on a specific narrow topic, that we can get way more in depth than we could if Ken Burns did one of his silly little 9-hour documentaries about disc golf, or 9 or 18 hours, however many it is. This is going to be the most comprehensive thing in the sport. So before I get to our guest tonight, please stick around. You guys, this is a treat beyond words. It's such an honor. Before that, I want to share again my ulterior motive for starting this podcast is that I am running a series of Blue Power Disc Golf events. I have 4 events coming up. Now, these are traditional PDGA disc golf tournaments. Come out, 100% payback in cash for pros, 100% payback in prizes for AMs, CTPs, A school. They're traditional disc golf tournaments. One division or some divisions play Saturday, some divisions play Sunday. At these events, the Blue Power part of this is on Saturday afternoon. There's going to be a free disc golf class for any adult or kid out there with special needs. So if you are in the community where I'm going to be in town for, and you know anybody with autism or Down syndrome or blind, paraplegic, CP, ADHD, kid or adult, bring them out to the free disc golf class. Everyone that comes out is going to get a golf disc just for having the courage to give our sport a try. And we're going to introduce disc golf to families that could really use an activity the family can do that doesn't cost money, and where they're going to be surrounded by the best humans on earth. And those are fighting words. Anybody wants to argue that disc golfers aren't the best humans on earth, fighting words. So that's why we're doing this. Now, boy, I just can't wait any longer. Let's bring our guests on, and then I'm going to give an introduction that I'm probably going to cry during. But for those of you out in the Midwest, you'll recognize Bill. I'm just going to go by nicknames. Old Man Wallace and Mom Wallace. How are you guys doing?
Fine. Doing fine. Thanks, Scott.
All right. So ready for the you guys are so humble. Part of you isn't going to like this introduction, but this is something that's really important. So I'm actually going to start your introduction just for a moment to talk about myself, because this is relevant to the role you guys play in our sport. So a little bit of trivia about me is that I was the first professional disc golfer to buy a house playing disc golf. Now, I didn't do it through prize money, obviously, not back in the 90s, but between sponsorship and endorsements and merchandising, being out of disc golfer, I actually became middle class. Now, coming from the early days of disc golf, the idea of a disc golfer becoming middle class is absolutely, it was unheard of. Now, the way that happens is not because of me. It wasn't my magnetism that made all this happen for myself. You know, it happened because there were people putting disc golf courses in the ground. There were local clubs hosting tournaments. There was manufacturers producing discs and pumping a ton of money into the sport. There was the Professional Disc Golf Association organized a tour. Everybody was contributing to grow this sport. And in addition to the people that, you know, get a lot of the recognition, there were the volunteers. I mean, thousands, probably tens of thousands of volunteers over the years have volunteered. And this is what old man and mom are. They are the probably the most active. I didn't know what the word to describe it. They've probably done more volunteer hours for the sport of disc golf than anybody. And so they will tell you, if you ask them, they'll say, well, we just do what we love to do. We're not doing anything special. That's what humble, beautiful people do. But one of the goals that I know that they had was they wanted not me, but the idea of me. They wanted people to go out and play this sport and be able to make a living and be able to make a life for themselves. And they gave tirelessly for decades to push for this just dream to happen. It wasn't a dream for them. They were making this dream possible for all the kids. And I think that they viewed them as their kids out on tour among all the locals and families they wanted to help as well. So the life I've had and the life that Paul Macbeth has and Eagle McMahon has and Ken Climo has, we're on the shoulders of people like old man and mom. These guys have literally, they literally travel around the country to NTs just to volunteer, just to give back to the sport and to people like me. So I'm trying not to cry, but there's no words to thank you guys. I mean, thank you guys so much for helping make, contribute to my life being what it is. So I'll get the sappy stuff out of the way, but thank you from me and all the other touring players.
You're welcome.
It's one thing that- I know you guys are so humble. You don't want to hear all this, but it's true. That's who you are. So I want to get to know you guys better. I mean, I've seen you at many tournaments. Obviously, everybody has in the Midwest. But I want to go back to the beginning. I know that, old man, you started before mom. How did you get introduced to this game?
Hey, Wilbur, in January, there were no stores that sold discs around here. But he found one and gave it to him for my birthday. Don't want the kid to feel bad, so I go out and I throw it once in a while. Didn't take long, and I was hooked. Loved the game. Terrible player, but I loved the game.
You have a reputation for being as bad at disc golf as you are as good of a human. And you're not ashamed of it. The audio cut out just for a second there. When was this that you started, and where was it?
That was close to 30 years ago, and Wilbur would come down to the house, and he'd go over to Bradley Park and play. Well, I loved to hike, so I would go over and hike the course with him, and then he bought me this plastic disc. So I had to throw it once in a while with him, and got to be playing quite regularly with him, and then wasn't too long, my second son come up along, and the three of us were playing a lot.
Okay. Do you remember what the first disc was?
Yes, it was a Shark.
That's actually, we used to always call the Shark the best first disc. I remember they used to give that out of World's Biggest back in the day.
Yes.
Okay. So you started taking up this hobby. Mom, what did you think of this game before you actually knew anything about it?
What? I didn't go over for a while. I let the guys do their thing. And then when he started helping with tournaments, I started out as a spotter. And I still have spotted once in a while.
Yeah.
Don't wait till you're 54 was the first time I threw a disc. That is way too old.
When you first threw a disc at 54?
Yes.
That's fantastic. So you started off playing, and then you were, when did you get more involved? For those of you who don't know, in Peoria, Illinois, Peoria is one of the little miniature epicenters of the early days of the sport. Two of the best players to come out of disc golf in the 90s, who we'll get to in a minute, came from Peoria. So when did you start getting more involved than just as a player, like as a rec player?
Yeah, well, I'm still a rec player. I would go up to Joliet and to Gary Lewis's tournaments and to Brian Cummings' tournaments. And they usually were AMs played on, or the lower AMs played on Saturday, and then the advanced and pros played on Sunday. Wilbur and I would go up together. We'd take the trailer and spend the night in the trailer. I'd play on Saturday, and he'd spot or whatever. And then on Sunday, I would spot, and he would play on Sunday. We'd come back home, we'd have fun. I started asking Brian and Gary different questions, how they did different things, why they did them that way, and got a little knowledge and decided, I bet I could do that myself. Come back to Peoria, tweaked a few of their ideas, and it's history from there. Took over the Peoria Open and just grew it.
Now, this was in 1994, or when did you do the Peoria
94,
Open?
I ran my first tournament, the Peoria Open.
See, I did my research this time. I'm getting better at this. So how did that first tournament go? I mean, was it like, did it blow up on you? Did it flow?
Marshall Hopkins was the tournament director, and he was obviously getting burnt out. When it was a turnout of like 30 players, and he was a little late getting there, so we took over for him just to get the registrations going. No pre-registration then. And I asked Marshall, I says, would you let me run it next year? He says, you think you can do it? Oh, let me try. Worst I can do is fail. And I said, the first thing I'm going to do is take it to McNaught. That was the toughest course we had around here. He says, there's your first mistake. Nobody's going to like it. It's too tough of a course. He had about 30 the last year he ran it. I had 121 the first year I ran it.
Actually, McNaughton is one of the courses, for those of you who, you know, a lot of you don't know this, but in the early days of the sport, it was generally assumed that every hole you had a really good shot of getting a two on. You know, a good score was a score in the low 40s. And McNaughton, I actually heard about McNaughton before I ever came to Illinois, because here was a course where low 50s was a good score. But that was unheard of back then, or practically unheard of.
I can remember for a number of years, the course record never went below, I think, 49 or 50. The course record.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember
coming out. Now, back in those early days, is this when Scott and Tim were on top? I mean, in the early 90s, mid 90s?
Yeah.
Okay. So Scott and Tim Martin, part of the fun of this podcast is I'm going to be dropping names on people that you might not know nowadays that had absolute game back then. And there was a couple brothers out there named Scott and Tim Martin who, because of life, they didn't get a chance to travel much. So if you lived outside of Illinois, you might not have known how good these guys were. But these were world-class, top 10 in the world players who didn't travel much and who just owned. They absolutely dominated your area for a decade or more?
Something like that. They were from Morton, which is 20 miles from here.
I thought they were from Peoria. Okay, see, that's how much I know.
Actually from Morton. Just across the river.
Okay.
And we've got two in Morton now.
So you started running the tournament. It started blowing up every year. It became it was a super tour, right?
I eventually did the first super tour in Illinois.
Oh, he was the first left-handed.
Scott was definitely the top left-handed player in the world.
Oh, God. Yeah, for sure. He was the top left. Oh, yeah. I mean, he finished second or third at Worlds 1 year. And at the time was probably one of the top three players in the world. It wasn't a fluke. And if you ask Scott who was better, him and his brother, he would say his brother. So that tells you how good those guys were. So you started running this tournament. Tell me about it. I mean, because back then everybody was experimenting with different ideas. And I mean, no one had a real good path of how to put on a good tournament. I mean, what did you do that was different?
Okay. Steve Maddle came up with this idea of the Illinois-Indiana series. He asked me if I wanted to be part of that for the Peoria Open. It was the first stop on the series. So I didn't have the advantage of a lot of events advertising it, other than mostly word of mouth, but was had enough base players here to get the word out. We had a good showing, and I was able to go to the other stops on the tour and see how the whole tour worked out as a series. And Well, I ended up getting Tournament Director of the Year for the Midwest that year. Didn't even know they had an award like that. That's not my goal, is awards. But that was thanks to Steve Maddow.
That's because you're humble. So, Mom, you were, where was your involvement by the time this tournament was happening?
Well, the first year, honestly, I just went, helped do players' packages and things like that. I really didn't get involved too much.
Not until it became a super tour.
Right.
Yeah, we were going to run three courses, and I needed another official for my third course.
Okay.
And I was having trouble finding a third official. Tell them the story.
Well, I took the test and wanted to surprise him. And he was getting down to the wire, and he kept saying, "We need another official." And I go, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it." And then finally I told him, "I did it."
Aced the test.
At that time.
Now, this test wasn't on the internet. I mean, this was back in 94, right?
Paper and pencil. Do it by mail.
So yep, had to do it by
paper and pencil. You hear that, kids? By the way, we're both in the same group where we can see kids these days. Yes, that's how an official test was back. You filled out a piece of paper, you put a stamp on an envelope, you mailed it in, and 2 weeks later you got something back that says whether you passed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh. Kids are spoiled these days.
Aren't they?
All right.
They really?
They are. So.
Oh, then in 95, I went to Wilson Park and spotted.
South Bend.
And okay. That's how I really started, was spotting at the current events.
Okay. I vaguely remember that. The thing I remembered being on tour in the 90s is that you guys would, the way it worked back then is that you would see the friends when you came to town, but you didn't typically see, other than touring players, you saw people in their town. But when you toured the Midwest, which is where that was the best tour back then, was in the Midwest, like you guys would just pop up at random places.
Yes. Talking about the history of the sport. The first event that used any form of electronics was South Bend Pro World. We had our trailer set up at Wilson Park, and they put a fax machine and a telephone line, and they would fax the scores from the other course. And then we would set up our boards, which were shutters. We didn't have the scoreboards.
Yeah.
We would hand fill out the papers and put them in the shutters for our starting lineup for this next round. And then we'd get our round finished up, and we'd fax our scores over to the next part.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I remember before those days at tournaments, nothing happened in real time back then. So I didn't know that South Bend was the first to do that.
Yes.
That's fantastic. So was that your first world championships that you went to?
That was the first one that Mom went to. In 94, okay. I went to Amworth in Cincinnati as a volunteer.
Okay. All right. So now you guys are going to Worlds. So it's now become a thing for you to just travel to volunteer for tournaments. Are tournament directors calling you and asking for help, or are you contacting them asking if they need help?
They call us.
Well, it went both ways. At the beginning, before 2004, it was usually, we were planning on coming to your event. Can we be of any help? We used disc golf as an excuse to go to an area we hadn't been. We would go early by a few days, do a little sightseeing, then help them out with the tournament and come home and have a blast. But we would ask them if we could be helped, because we were going to be there anyway. And usually they says, "Well, yeah, sure, we'll take all the help we can get." But then in 2004, Becky Zalek put us on the map. She let tournament directors know after 2004 that you're bringing tournament course directors in from out of town. This is the way you treat them. It's the way she treated us. And that is the standard now.
And
really?
I love
and then, wait, now, what is this again?
Pardon? The standard, yeah. Oh, she set the standard.
But who said, who was it that said it?
And the tournament would pay for our hotel. And that made it possible for us to go to a lot more tournaments. It wasn't a prerequisite that our hotel be paid for. That means we could do more tournaments because we didn't have to take as much money out of pocket. We're not rich people. We didn't, you know, pay for our own way always until 2004 when Becky convinced other tournament directors to pay for your out-of-town staff, pay for their hotel.
Gotcha. Okay. That's beautiful. So, all right. So before we go any further past that point, let's go back a little bit. Who were the people that were involved in helping you run the tournaments back then? I know Wilbur was involved, but like who, like, let's give some shout outs. Who else was the big contributors with you guys?
Here in Peoria, we also had Chuck, our second son, and Strasser. From Bloomington Normal, and his wife Kat, and Wilbur's wife Linda, and that was the early Team Wallace.
Okay, there's not even any words to describe how cool your family is. I mean, it's just, and there's some families out there. There's the Jenkins, there's the Jerez's. I mean, there's some famous Frisbee families, but you guys are up there on the Mount Rushmore of famous Frisbee families, I think. Before we get to 2004, it's getting into the 90s, right? It's getting like late 90s. Where were you going? Like, were you starting to become a regular at the World Championships already, or?
No. We traveled mostly in the Midwest, just the two-day tournaments. I was still working and only had like 2 weeks vacation a year. And Worlds, that takes a week's vacation right there. So I retired in 2007, and that's when we started hitting more and more major tournaments, majors, NTs, A-tiers, anywhere in the country.
And then we do a lot with the PDGA. I love it. Help do check-in. And that's where I see a lot of
She would do check-in, and I would do field events and double.
Okay. Now, at what point did you start going to tournaments and people started to recognize you? Like, people that you didn't know were recognizing you guys as being icons. I mean, at some point that happened.
We had no idea what kind of effect we were having on disc golf. We had a son that lived in Jacksonville, Florida, and we went down there on vacation one year to see him. And we went over to the course there by the racetrack, behind the racetrack, to have a casual round, just the two of us, and have a little fun, enjoy it. And somebody from the other side of the course saw us and yelled at us, "Mom, an old man." He'd been up to Peoria to play the Peoria Open. That was Mike Barnett.
Okay. Now, one of the things that I'm guessing, I don't want to put words in your mouth. When you see the top pros out there, I mean, do you look up to them as like the top pros in the sport you love?
No.
There are friends.
When somebody would ask us, who's your favorite for this tournament? We don't pick favorites. They're all friends. We want every one of them to win, if possible. That can't happen.
Yeah.
So rather than cheer for anybody, we wouldn't cheer for anybody.
Wow, that's really, really, really cool.
Yes. Some of them have become quite close friends.
Yeah. Well, the reason I was asking is because all the top players know you guys, right? I mean, if you see Barry Schultz, Barry Schultz, he comes up, gives you a hug, right?
That's my buddy.
Yeah.
If he don't doesn't walk by me when we're at a tournament, I would be heartbroken if he didn't come up and give me a hug. That's just him.
Yeah.
When he sees me, he has to give me my hug.
Well, he's a guy,
I love Barry like a brother. So, all right. So now you're traveling around. Now you guys are becoming famous also, right? I mean, whether you want to believe it or not, you are. And you're getting admiration. I mean, you're getting praise. You're getting thanks. I mean, does that, and I'm asking into the minds of just humble people. When people praise you for what you do, does it just wash off you because you're just doing what you love? Or does it really feel like, you know, you take it to heart?
It's all about us having fun. If we weren't having fun, we wouldn't do it. The praise, the pats on the back, they're nice, but that's not why we do it. It's all about us having fun. But we do appreciate all of the congratulations that we get, and a couple of awards we picked up along the way too. They're nice, but that wasn't the reason.
Okay. Well, what about watching the sport? Go ahead, Mom.
I said they are very special, dude.
The several of the awards we've gotten.
Now, what about the sport itself? Because, like, what do you guys think when you see the sport from where it was when you started to where it is now? I mean, what do you think of that?
It's really growing. I love it. And just like seeing younger kids involved in it now, much younger, 5, 6 years old kids playing, it's amazing.
When I first got involved in it and was looking for sponsors, any company that I hit, the first thing I had to do was explain to them what disc golf was.
Yep.
And I had sponsors that repeated year in, year out. And it was easier every year when they repeated, because that means I was time I could spend with a new sponsor and explain to them what disc golf is.
Right.
Well, now, or the last time I was out looking for sponsors, I would hit a company up and they say, "Oh, that's a fantastic sport. My son plays, my wife plays, my grandmother plays." And those things just blow my mind how it's become, everybody knows what the sport is now.
I said, even you go to doctors and you go to a doctor's office now and then go, "Oh yeah, disc golf, yeah."
Yeah, that's been one of my favorite things that I've got to see over the years too. Do you guys take pride? Like, because whether you want to believe it or not, you are like many, many people, you are part of the reason why this sport has become what it is. Do you feel a sense of pride at that you are a part of it, or do you just look back and watch?
Very definitely have pride in the things that we've accomplished. I wish my dad and my mom were aware of some of what we've accomplished just because of the love of the sport. My mother knew what we did, but she would never go out to an event. And my dad passed away before we got involved in disc golf. But I know he'd be proud of us.
Wow, that's just fantastic. Let's back up just a little bit. I want to hear about some of the events you've been to, because once you were able to travel to more events, like, you guys traveled to the events. You didn't just go to an extra NT a year. You were like traveling to as many as you could, right?
A few years ago, we did 11 tournaments in 1 year. And that was, we were starting to slow, we're saying we had to slow down. The year before we did, I think, 9 or 10. And we says, we've got to slow down. We're getting older and it's getting harder to do this. So the next year we did 11. Well, we did slow down. Last year we did, I think, 7. And this year may only be 3 or 4.
Okay. So I got a question mostly for Mom. Well, for both of you, but mostly for Mom. So back in 1994, there weren't a lot of women that played disc golf.
No. Very, very few.
Very few. Now the women's division is.
I think at one of the at Wilson Park, I think there was only a couple women that played. Don't ask me their name; I can't remember.
So now that's not the case anymore.
No.
What do you think about watching the women's game? Yeah.
I wish there was more still. And honestly, we ran the women's for
U.S. Women's Championship. I would rephrase that question. What did we get out of the U.S. Women's Championship?
But the women are so much, honestly, more thankful. And the camaraderie is different with the women than the men.
Yeah, they're very competitive. But the camaraderie is just as important.
So now let's back up, because you guys ran, I'm going to get this wrong, but you ran the women's national championships for 6 years. I just made up the numbers. How close am I?
7 years.
7 years. That was I'll pretend it wasn't a guess then. I'll pretend I was close. Tell me about the first one.
Okay. Well, it was ran for 3 years out at Rock Hill in connection with the USDGC. The PDGA asked them to let the women's tournament go so the women could be spotlighted more. And that's how we got involved with it. We bid on having it here, and the women told the PDGA, keep it at Peoria. We love it there. And we kept it in Peoria until I retired. I retired from running it so we could spend more time on the road.
And see him more often.
Yeah, he's more often.
Gotcha. So tell me about the first one. How many competitors? Tell me what it was like.
33 women, I do believe. It was a blast. The women had a ball with it. It wasn't very big, but it was everything they wanted. We gave every one of them a piece of paper and asked them, please tell us what you liked and what you didn't like. We're going to listen to you, and when we do this next year, we're going to have it even better yet. And every year we grew it. I think it was 1 year that the numbers were down just a tad, ended up with quite a competition between Texas Women's Championship and U.S. Women's. Vinnie Milliver and I were competing against each other to have the best numbers. And everybody thought that Vinny and I were enemies, that we really weren't happy with each other.
And they were just
We were good friends. We fed off of each other. Vinny and I are still good friends.
Gotcha. So I want to know about another big tournament in Illinois, but I'm going to start by saying, give it a little bit of history of the sport. There was a huge disc golf tournament back in 1993. Huge disc golf tournament in Sterling, Illinois, called the Senesippi Open. And the reason it was a huge disc golf tournament is I think they had $500 added to the purse. Maybe that was right. I know that I was like that. In Dayton, Ohio, and we drove 12 hours because a tournament with $500 added to the purse was unheard of back then. That was the Senesippi Open. It was famous in the sport. So, things have changed a little bit when it comes to big tournaments in Illinois, I venture to say. So
definitely
tell me about the Ledgestone Open. I mean, you guys have been involved in it. Give me a little history. I want to know about the tournament.
Well, let's back up to Senesippi just a moment here.
Okay, good.
I would go and play on Saturday, and Terry Batten was the tournament director.
Terry.
And he was a pro player. He played on Sunday. So he would play on, I would play on Saturday, and then when he played on Sunday, I ran the tournament for him and had a blast doing it. And that was back in this 1993 time span when you're talking
about. Hold on a minute. Wait. You were the, because I was there in 93. You were the tournament, you were the tournament director, so I was there.
On the pro day. But Terry was calling all of the shots, and I just did what he told me to do.
And I got lots of shirts from him.
Yes. We just did whatever Terry told us to do. So Terry didn't have to think about it while he was out playing.
So that must have been I met you guys there, even though I don't remember it. But that must have been where I first met you.
That's very possible. Then Nate Heidel come up with the Ledgestone, which kind of a spin off of what used to be the Peoria Open, but it's don't want to take anything away from Nate. It is a standalone tournament, and he is fantastic at raising money. And he's gets a lot of people to come because it's a big purse, and they have to come because of all of the cash added.
Yeah. So it just has to blow your mind, right? I mean, like, you're literally watching the biggest prize money tournament in the sport happening at the same place where you were really psyched to get 33 women for a tournament. And well, for a tournament that you took over that had 30 total players, like you literally saw it from 30 players throughout the first $100,000 tournament in your
Yeah, to 900 players.
Yeah, 900 players. Yeah. Pretty ridiculous.
And have four or five tournaments that have 900 players a year now.
So what is your involvement in that tournament? I mean, I assume you're involved, but I'm not sure.
And we really don't do much at the tournaments here. With Ledgestone,
we're not.
Yeah, quite often we're out of town. And in order to be involved, you have to be here to do the work. Generally, we'll show up at check-in with Ledgestone. His people he had doing check-in, they asked for a little help, so we pitched in and do it. And that was because of who was doing check-in. We did it for them. And if they hadn't asked us, we wouldn't have done it. And it was that simple. Just helping our friends out.
So I want to put you guys on the spot a little bit, and I want both of your opinions on this. So what is the one thing a tournament can do to be successful? And you can gauge success by any metric you want, but like, what is the one thing that they need to do, a tournament director, that you would tell them?
Be good to your staff, your volunteers.
Okay, fair.
You can't get enough volunteers. Don't ever turn someone away that wants to volunteer.
Okay.
Give them all the proper tools to work with. Give your players exactly what you promised. Nothing less. You can do something extra, fine, but don't shortchange the players. They were expecting something, make sure they get it. They'll come back because they knew, will recognize that you ran a good, fair tournament, exactly as you represented it.
I love it. Okay, and now on the other side, you've seen a lot of tournaments, that have made mistakes. What's probably the one big mistake that a tournament, if someone's running a tournament for the first time, what's your biggest fear that they're going to make a mistake on?
They make too many changes at the last second, and the players don't know what to expect.
And the staff.
Yeah, and the staff for that matter, too. Yeah, you make changes and then forget to tell the staff that you made a change.
Okay. Gotcha.
We've been on the end.
So you said you don't have a favorite player. Do you have any favorite tournaments, or is it just as hard to pick those out?
Just as hard.
Me personally, I like the women's tournaments.
Yeah. We haven't missed U.S. women's since 2002. So, yes, U.S. women's is probably our favorite tournament.
Gotcha. So, and you have to love where the women's game has come. I mean, how good they are now. I mean, it's ridiculous how good Katrina and Paige. I don't want to start listing them because then I'm going to leave out so many good players.
Right.
Yes. But see, you guys were around when Juliana was battling Elaine, the two best players in the sport there was no third place at the time. And they battled for years. But the game now is next level, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Speaking of Juliana, the first tournament she played outside of Iowa was the Peoria Open. And she was a green amateur. And she won her division. In 1994, was the first Worlds, Am Worlds I was on staff for in Cincinnati. And Juliana won that as an Am player. And I can't remember if it was 95, that Pro Worlds, that Juliana won her first Pro World Championship, that I was fortunate enough to be at both of those. And she was like one of our kids.
Well, do you feel like that about a lot of the players? I mean, do you feel like they're your kids?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And not just the players. Some of the PDGA staff. Yeah. They're, ask my boys. Yeah, they're as close to us as the family is.
Wow. This
And again, I don't want to pick names. I'll let somebody out. Somebody will feel slighted. And I don't want them to do that.
Okay. Totally fair. So we'll kind of wrap this up on a couple, just throw them out there questions. Do you guys, either of you, have any go-to stories? I mean, you're getting together at a disc golf barbecue. Like, do you have any stories that you just usually have to share?
There's one that I've shared a few times, and it's a Barry story. We were spotting at the USDGC hole 18. We did that every year for 6 or 7 years. And Barry would come through playing hole 18, last hole, and he would stop. He'd give mom the hug. He'd wave at me on the other side of the fairway, and then he'd finish his hole. Well, he didn't stop and give mom her hug, and he missed his putt. And before he even went to scoring, he went back over to mom, and he says, "I hurt myself. I didn't give you my hug. And I didn't make my putt. That was his fault."
That, shame on him.
We had a lot of fun with the golfers camping at our backyard, have campfires. At one time, we had 30 campers in our backyard.
Yeah, campers and tents. Yeah.
We had 30 campers and tents in our backyard.
Yeah, we've got a half a city block that we can camp in.
I think that's wonderful.
What's sad is knowing that we're not going to be able to keep doing this.
Yeah, travel days are few and far between now. Getting older, health's going down. It happens.
You know, well, part of my goal with this podcast, and I don't want to take this into a downer place because this has been one of the most enjoyable hours I've had in forever. But I do want to get people, I want to immortalize people because none of us are going to be around forever. And, you know, I want something that's permanent because when I'm gone, when you're gone, when Barry Schultz is gone, you know, this is going to be something that we could have that's going to be left. And the next generation is going to have access to this forever. And so part of my goal with this podcast is, you know, I've looked at some of the people that, you know, the Tim Selinskys out there that I'm not going to get to do something like this with. And so I do want to get to people before, you know, and again, I won't go make it any more of a downer, but that's part of why I want to do this. You know, it's really, I think it's important. So I would like to ask you guys one open question. You know, this is going to be something that'll permanently be stored on a website on YouTube for people to access forever. Is there anything you'd like to share just that you want to put out there that will just simply exist for as long as disc golf exists?
I do have something that I've said to a number of people already. Thank you for allowing us to be a part of such a fantastic sport. And we really mean that from the bottom of our heart. That thank you, all of the players, the PDGA, for allowing us to be a part of it. We kind of feel like we push our way in sometimes. They don't really need us. But before the tournament's over, they're thanking us for being there and what help we gave them. And it's because we want to do it.
How about you, Mom?
What he said. I'm not much of a talker, but it's, to me, I hope someone else takes over and does stuff.
She's really enjoyed doing check-in at AM and Pro Worlds and any major U.S. Masters or what women, whatever, because every player that check in has to come past her. she gets those hugs from all of those guys and gals. And those hugs mm-hmm. are special to her.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to leave you guys with one thing. So I was looking for a picture of you, old man, to put up on the Facebook post about the event. And I was so touched because when I went into your Facebook photos and I started scrolling down right there at the top, you put a picture up. Before I spoke with you about this podcast, you had a picture up of me and you together. And it means something to be meant. It means something when to be have someone to mean something to somebody else. How about that? And so when I saw that picture on there, my eyes watered up and it made me feel good that you felt that was an important picture for you to share with me. It touched me, and I really appreciated that.
I am in awe of all of the number of named players, big name players, that I can count as friends. I don't know of another sport that I could have got involved in that it could have been like that. I personally am not an athletic person. I'm not a competitive person, never have been, had no desire to be, but I love the involvement that I've been able to have in disc golf and the acceptance that we've gotten from the people in disc golf.
Well, I guess we'll leave it at that, unless you have any parting words, which I guess we kind of already covered. I just want to tell you guys both, I love you to death. I'm looking forward to the next time we get to see you. I plan on touring next year. I expect you guys to be at some events that I'll be at. And it's been a real honor and a real treat. And I hope everybody out there enjoyed it as much as I did.
Well, I could make one request. I love this idea that you're doing with the history of the sport.
Yes.
What I'd like to see you do is put these interviews on DVDs and sell them as a series at $5 or $10 a piece. I think they'd sell. I'd sure like to have a copy of them.
I love. Well, your that's copy just, won't cost anything.
No, I do. That's just a thought for you.
Hey, I'm. Believe me, I'm absolutely open to anything to make a few bucks, especially if I'm going to be out on tour again. So. Thank you, guys. Love you to death. And thank you just from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Wilbur, who we're going to bring on. Wilbur was in the technical difficulties, but he'll be on the History of Disc Golf in Illinois podcast, which we'll do at some point. So we'll be talking to Wilbur and maybe your other kids soon. But thank you, guys. Love you.